Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. This is an extended interview between Dr. Susan Blackmore and V.S. Ramachandran, the director of the Center of Brain and Cognition at the University of California, San Diego. The interview took place at the home of noted British psychologist Richard Gregory and forms part of Susan's book, Conversations on Consciousness.
Why is consciousness so interesting and difficult?
Well, in a sense, it's the biggest challenge to science, because all the problems we've tackled and solved have to do with the external world, such as DNA or Earth not being the center of the universe, cosmology, string theory. But here you're now finally confronted with the biggest problem of all, namely understanding the very organ that made all those other discoveries possible, turning on itself and asking, who am I? You know, I don't mean in the metaphysical sense, you know, simply here's this blood and flesh generating this amazing sense of self, looking back at your own origins in time and questioning its own, you know, its own origins, its own existence, its own future, what happens when I die, all of those questions, which people have been preoccupied for thousands of years, and we can now begin to approach it scientifically. And of course, I'm always confronted with this because I see patients who have damaged bits of the brain, which changes your sense of embodiment, your sense of self, your qualia, all of those things that philosophers discuss. I'm dealing with this empirically every day, you know.
Before we go any further, I want to take you up on this whole business of qualia. You're using the concept here all the time. What is a qualia?
Okay. The only way I can state it clearly is with the old famous thought experiment. That is, if you're a super scientist and you come to me and you say you're a Martian super scientist and you don't have qualia, that's not important for the argument, but you're a Martian super scientist and you say, Rama, you're a robot called Rama, I'm going to figure out how you see red, and I'm going to look through your brain, into your brain, here's all the pattern of activity, you get to the Broca's area and you say red, the muscles are active, and you think of red apples, the memories are active, all of this happens, and this is it. And you say, well, that's all fine, okay, but this description does not contain my ineffable experience of redness, which I can never tell you, A, because you're a Martian, or because you're a colorblind. You don't even need a Martian. Let's say a colorblind super scientist, the whole famous philosophical riddle.
So if you divide people into those who think that there is something extra, the qualia, the experience, the subjectivity, you would fall into that category.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything extra. I think you need to explain how it comes about. I'm not saying there's anything spooky stuff going on.
All right, are you saying that if you understood all of the information processing,
strategies,
all the language, all the things that the brain was doing, then you would understand?
Yes, oh absolutely. I think you would understand qualia in the same sense that you understand an electron or anything else. Then you don't go on to say, but what the hell is it? And you're going to do that with qualia as well. But I'm saying the description in mechanistic terms by the Martian scientist does not, that's how I state the problem of qualia, does not contain within it the experience of qualia. To explain that, you need to take an extra step.
Right.
And I think that extra step is at some point in evolution, the sense of self emerged. And that requires this meta-representation.
Yeah.
And that is, it creates another representation of the pre-existing sensory representations for economically juggling symbols and communicating. And that requires this simultaneous existence of a sense of self, language, all of this, and it emerged at a specific stage in evolution. It may involve specific regions of the brain, and I have some ideas about that. I think it involves the TPO junction, which is involved in synesthetic abstraction and correspondence, which we were talking about yesterday in the lecture. It involves the Wernicke's area concerned with semantics, okay, and the anterior cingulate involved in attention and emotion. So in other words, not the entire brain, but specific circuits. There I agree with Crick and Koch, but they don't specify which structures, nor do they talk about meta-representations, nor do they talk about the sense of self. Maybe they talk about it tangentially, but not, you know, it's not their main thrust.
What would you say was the minimal requirement then for self and qualia, these two aspects that emerge together?
The minimal requirement is the creation of what I call this meta-representation. To give you an example.
So it could be a very simple meta-representation, and then it would be simple experience.
That's correct.
Correspondingly.
Now people often ask me, well, if this is true, then don't you need another meta? Isn't it the endless regress problem? Isn't it just the homunculus? The answer is not the homunculus, it's another brain process, A. And who said you need an endless regress? See, in evolution, having one meta representation does most of what you need for the job.
But you must say...
So you don't need another thing looking at it. That's enough.
Those people are right in this sense that you need to say why that level of... You've got a regress, and you're saying it stops here.
Correct.
You've got to say why it stops there.
Because with that, you have a sense of self emerging and
right,
language
and, that's what you
and
say
symbol
is
juggling.
Essential.
That's
okay,
essential.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Now, you have said in some of your writings, you've used phrases like some neurons are qualia laden, or some have qualia attached to them, or something.
Yeah, that's just shorthand. I mean, I don't. The cricket cards
really
tend to do that much more than I do.
Yes.
What I'm saying is these circuits are qualia laden. It could be that the spinal cord in itself experiences quote unquote qualia, but it's a misuse of the word. I'm saying the qualia cannot exist without the self, by definition.
So
and therefore, it's a misuse of the term qualia.
Let me get this straight, see if I've understood it. When you say something is qualia laden, I infer as a reader that you mean somehow these separate things called qualia are sort of attached to these neurons.
No.
But you're actually denying that you mean that at all.
I deny that.
Good. Oh, good. Yeah. That
so I'm not
sense.
A dualist, I'm a neutral monist. But the trouble with neutral monism is it doesn't then go far enough. It doesn't say exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to push it to the neural circuitry and say once the sense of self emerged. See, it's kind of a funny problem, right? Because in a sense, you have to know that you know, otherwise you don't know. Okay? I mean, you see, I think that's the crux of the matter. And that's why you need the sense of self, which knows that it knows. Now, you don't need an endless, it's not an endless regress, because look, I can say, you know, I know, that I had an affair with your wife.
You didn't.
But if I say, I know that you know that I know that you know that I know, you start losing the thread. So, like an echo, okay? So there's only so many steps that the brain can handle, and that's adequate for the sense of self. Okay, so it's not an endless regress. There is no homunculus, it's other brain structures. And qualia is part of the, qualia and self, as I said, two sides of the coin. Now, what's the evidence for all this? You can look at all the brain lesion studies from this point of view. So I would say, blindsight, the Milner phenomenon, so Milner and Goodhair, that phenomenon and blindsight, Weisskranz blindsight phenomenon, you have a representation, a sensory representation, but you don't have a meta representation. It's uncoupled from that. That's why the chap moves his finger and touches it, but is unaware of what's going on. His self, quote unquote, is uncoupled from it, and is unaware of what's going on. Okay. Conversely, it's part of the same thought. Conversely, in Anton syndrome, where a person is completely blind because of damage to the visual cortex, says, oh, I can see fine. He has a spurious meta representation. Okay, even though he doesn't have a primary representation, you ask him to touch something, he can't. But he's got a spurious meta representation. You can talk about various phenomena. You can talk about hypnosis. You can talk about every conceivable clinical neurological phenomenon that affects consciousness from this point of view of this dichotomy between having a representation versus having a representation of the representation.
Okay, what about pain? Now, you've made a case here that qualia, i.e. immediate subjective experience, only comes about with this big leap to self-concept and language and so on. Now, I think when I look at my cat and it's got a thorn and it comes limping in through the cat flap looking pathetic with a thorn in its paw and I have to take it out and it then seems happier, I think it is experiencing pain in the sense it's got the painfulness of pain. It really doesn't like it. It feels like something to that cat.
Yeah.
Of course I can't know and I can be as skeptical as anything about it, but that looks to me from the outside as being as much a claim for qualia as if I poke Richard here and hurt his arm.
I know what you mean, yeah. I think that's not the case. I think that, for example, even in you, your withdrawal from a hot kettle is a different pain from the pain that you then you can contemplate on. In the first case, the pain of withdrawal from a kettle, there is no qualia and no meta representation.
Indeed.
In the second case, where you contemplate the pain, you have a meta representation, you can communicate with others, it has all kinds of links with memories, where you say, oh, pain, that's a bad thing, let me not do this again. Oh, let me tell this other chap about my pain.
Yeah.
Let me take some medicine for this pain. So it's got all these vast semantic implications, and you need that in order for it, and the link to the sense of self in order for full-fledged qualia to emerge. Whereas
that
the reflex withdrawal, so the same way, I think the cat is responding to the pain. Now, however much you might be tempted to infer that it's contemplating its agony, it isn't.
That is extremely plausible and makes a lot of sense, but does it mean that it doesn't matter?
That question could be asked of, that could be under anesthesia. You could say if somebody's under anesthesia, you uncoupled he, the person, the self, and therefore qualia experienced by the self, from the pain.
But it's more
immediate.
But he
could say, my God, his spinal cord is, so you never put somebody under anesthetic. His spinal cord is still conscious. You know, you can do a spinal block. That's unethical. You know, that's no more a problem than the cat problem.
But the cat problem is serious because of factory farming, because of all kinds of cruel practices to wildlife, because
but this
people
is cruel practices to spinal cord.
Yeah, but what is your but what is your answer about the factory farm? Does it matter? Do you want to see people, treating the animals better, or does it not matter because they're not having qualia?
See, to me, that problem, it's like abortion. You know, in other words, you're confounding ethics with science. In other words, somebody could always make the case you're preventing a human being from existence.
That's
and
a different
therefore,
let's yeah. stick with the consciousness argument, and I'm really not going to let you get out of it. We're going to stick with the consciousness. If you follow your theory through logically, you would say that, let's say a cow going to the slaughter. Now, you can kill it instantly, or you can kill it in a slow way, which to us would be very painful.
Halal, or whatever it's called, yeah. Well, I think that as mammals, we empathize with certain behavior patterns. And this makes you think that the cow has full-fledged self and qualia, and therefore you shouldn't hurt it. But then you can say, why am I a vegetarian? You know, so I'm saying, you know, once you start getting into ethics and start asking, at what point is it ethical does an embryo become conscious, and therefore you can talk about murder versus just abortion? You know.
So I guess you're saying something like this: I'm a vegetarian, I don't want to eat animals, I would rather they were killed in a nice way, but actually I don't think they feel pain.
That's correct. I would say that if pushed.
Fair enough. You have been pushed.
Yeah. I mean, other example, by the way, is you need a sense of self to deceive people. This has been said before, but what I'm trying to do is put it all together in one package.
Indeed, yeah.
And to give you a simple example, people say, oh, but a bird will feign injury of its wing to deceive the predator. So it has tremendous concern and pity for its child and maternal feelings. So how can you deny the same qualia and this to the bird, you know, that a human mother experiences to a child? I would say there's a key difference. The human mother knows that she's deceiving. The bird doesn't. And how do I know that? Because the bird, supposing it wanted to deceive another, let's say it's feigning injury. You think it's feigning injury to deceive the predator. It isn't. Okay? The only way you could prove that is if it now, in a normal situation, feigned the injury to deceive, say, the male bird to come to its aid and be nice and, you know, just like humans sometimes do, you know, pretend you're sick to get pampered. But the bird cannot do that. It can only do this feigning for one purpose, namely for deceiving the predator. It's a fixed action pattern. It doesn't know it's deceiving. Whereas a human knows he or she is deceiving, and therefore you can deploy it in all kinds of situations. This, by the way, is related to Searle's point about semantics. And this is where the Wernicke's area comes in. And it's related to abstract juggling of symbols, qualia, self, all of this together emerged in evolution and language.
I want to change tack completely.
Sure.
How did you get into this in the first place?
Well, I mean, you know, if you're trained to be a physician and you're examining neurological patients, it's inevitable that you become interested in consciousness.
Oh, an awful lot. What was it that made you the difference? Because a huge number of neurologists just stay away from consciousness. It's too much of a trendy topic. They think it's dangerous scientifically. There are all sorts of reasons why people don't want to mess with it. But you're one of the unusual people
who's prepared
to get tangled up with it. So I want to know how that started. What do you first remember about what made you think about the problem of consciousness?
Well, seeing people with strange mental phenomena, strange neurological conditions, forces you to confront this problem. And I think partly my training back in India and in the early days in here. See, people often get brainwashed by the scientific community. And you know, behaviorism had a pernicious influence. And people said it's not fashionable to think about internal mental states. People are saying this about vision. You know, it's all Stevens-style psychophysics. You know, you're not allowed to ask the subject what he's actually experiencing. It was Richard who turned the tide in some ways and revived the Helmholtzian view. And I think I've done that partly for neurology. You know, there was a golden age of neurology when people were asking, all the neurologists were interested in this. And medical students were interested.
Yeah, Hewling-Jackson.
Hewling-Jackson, Charcot, Freud, all of these people.
Yeah.
And then it was eclipsed by behaviorism. In neurology, they said you measure EMGs. Okay, don't ask the patient what he's experiencing, because you'll be misled. And then, of course, throw the baby out with the bathwater. But I think in this sort of quote-unquote generation, I think I have done a lot to try and revive that approach of good old-fashioned 19th century neurology.
But what made you do that? What made the difference? You must be able to...
Because I was just untrammeled by fashion.
So it was coming from India and being right outside of
partly.
That enabled you to say, oh, I'm not going to fall for that.
That's correct. Yeah, that's nonsense.
Mimetic indoctrination.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go back to the central issue, really, the whole qualia thing. Do you believe that zombies are possible?
No, they're not possible. I think if you create a creature which is identical to us, which is what cloning is, or something like that, it doesn't matter how you create the zombie, it'll be fully conscious in the human sense. Now,
does it have to be physically identical, or could it be identical?
What if you have the information flow, which is identical, but it's made of dinner plates or silicon chips?
Yeah.
I'm agnostic about that. I think that it's the information that's critical, you know, so in that sense I'm a functionalist, but I'm not sure.
Do you believe in free will?
Well, I think that once this meta-representation evolved, that for some reason had to be linked with the sense of volition. And I can tell you why. Again, my intuition on this comes from clinical neurology more than anything else. And I'll tell you two things. One is, of course, the famous Libet experiments. And I recently, in my reflexes, suggested a variant of that, which I believe Gray Walter has done something similar, although he has never published it. And the variant of that is, you know the experiment that if you wiggle your finger, you get a readiness potential. And it turns out, you can tell somebody in the next 10 minutes, wiggle your finger 3 times, anytime you will it. And you do it and you find the readiness potential actually happens half a second to a second earlier. So this has this paradoxical flavor to it, but in fact, it's not a great paradox. The idea is some internal sense of willing. Okay, the idea is how come the sense of willing
comes too late. I mean, the traditional interpretation of Libet's experiment is that the sensation of willing
comes later.
Comes too late. It comes after the beginning of the readiness potential, so it's not causal.
Yeah.
You have a different interpretation?
No. What I'm saying is there I have a Dennett-like approach to this, and I'm saying that there's a spatiotemporal smearing of events in the brain, so you don't expect it necessarily to be precisely synchronized.
You've mentioned the fact that coming from India made you freer in some respects, coming into the strictures of science.
Well, for two reasons. One is what I said about you don't absorb the fashions around you.
Yes, yes.
That's one reason.
And the other thing you've mentioned here is a kind of worldview that comes from Hinduism, I assume, does it?
I think that was a retro thing. I mean,
right.
You know, I don't think it affected my main research in any way.
But
except to the extent that, you know, maybe you are more interested in phenomena of consciousness if you come from an Eastern tradition, but
yeah, I mean,
not in any
direct... You are bringing a new, because you're a real Indian person, you're not just sort of, you know, you've actually brought up in India, you've been taught Hinduism a lot of your life, you've really got something to offer that most Western scientists haven't. Can you think of any other ways in which that's enriched what you're doing? Or helps you
I don't think there's a direct link or even an indirect link between my upbringing as a Hindu and my science. It's just coincidental, I think. You know, I may be wrong, because you can always, you know, maybe I'm confabulating, but it's coincidental that the scientific work is not incompatible with the ancient Hindu worldview. But some of those ideas are sufficiently nebulous, you can fit anything. But the other thing I'll say is, being raised in India, the emphasis there in clinical medicine is very pragmatic and, you know, goal-oriented. And this intense pragmatism and goal-orientedness, you know, makes you impatient with philosophical accounts.
Mm.
You know, you want to solve the problem,
mm-hmm.
You're goal-oriented. But secondly, also very primitive equipment, so you have to rely a lot on intuition.
Mm.
And I'd say people, you know, carrying lots of fancy gadgets and equipment is actually a bad thing. If you don't have a lot of equipment, fancy equipment and toys and gadgets, it forces you to be ingenious, as in Rutherford's lab in Cambridge, you know, with sealing wax and shoestring, you know. So it forces you to be ingenious, and then that becomes second nature. And even to this day, I feel uncomfortable when the gap between the raw data and the final result, you know, is too big, you know. And it takes a lot of the charm out of science, the excitement out of science, and it gives a lot of scope for massaging the data. This is why, see, a lot of the imaging studies you see, people are, you know, nature will publish, there's a 10 times more likelihood of Nature publishing an imaging study, however bad the study is, than is publishing a psychophysical study. It wasn't true 30 years ago, 20 years ago. Because it's sexy, people like to see pictures, no other reason. And I think all this gee whiz neophrenology, most of it is going to go, you know, vanish. And then you're going to ask important functional questions about the brain and what's interacting with what, and then make predictions about, you know, what's going on. You need to understand the functional logic of the system before you start asking what parts of the brain are involved. Okay? Instead of just, you know, let's see what lights up when somebody does something.
Yeah.
So that's what I think imaging is going to be very valuable, but much of it that's done these days is off the mark, wide off the mark.
Okay, last question. How has tangling with consciousness all this time changed you as a person?
Well, I can't give you a very coherent answer to that. I mean, it just gives you a sense of humility, I suppose. You know, I don't mean humility in the sense of, you know, in the social sense, but it sort of gives you a sense of awe. At the same time, a sense of humility. As I said, you're part of this great ebb and flow, and there is no separate soul or self. At the same time, I'm saying you are special in some way. You're different from even a great ape. You know, so Owen, the great Owen-Huxley debate, Owen was in fact right. He was not right about the hippocampus major. He was not right about that. There's no special unique structure in humans. But he was on the right track in saying that we are special and different from the great ape. And there is a huge, big jump, a qualitative jump, between them and us. And I think that requires the creation of the meta-representation, the accelerated development of the angular gyrus in the left hemisphere, the supramarginal gyrus representing intentions, and the links to the anterior cingulate, Wernicke's area for semantics, all of that circuitry became much more sophisticated in humans than in the apes.
Do you do any first-person practice of any kind? Do you meditate?
I don't, and I'm ashamed of that because, you know, everybody asks me that, and I have an open mind about it, but you know, I come from India and people say, how come you don't meditate, or how come you... You know, I think sometimes there's a little bit of what Freud would call a reaction formation. You know, you sort of come from that tradition and you deliberately stay away from it because you say, well, what has this really resulted in? But now I'm much more open to such ideas and it's worth exploring scientifically. Trouble is, you know, the people who study these things, you know, very often they're on the fringe, you know, unfortunately. And then when they produce a study, it's often not properly controlled. So for example, they say meditation improves your health and well-being and all of that. But is it better than a game of tennis? Now, I think it probably is, by the way. I'm not
the
saying
the evidence
it
suggests it isn't. The evidence suggests the tennis is better. In terms of relaxation and stress coping.
So that's alarming because you're saying all these esoteric practices are no better than
for relaxation, no. Yeah. The evidence is very clear that for relaxation and stress.
But then somebody could be using the wrong measure.
You know, of course they could. Yeah. But
an Indian mystic would say there is some higher dimension you're tapping into, whether it's tantra or meditation, which enriches your mind and you become more enlightened, and you can't do a simple measurement of heart rate.
Exactly.
And that might be true.
Yes.
But then you need to find something to measure.
But let's forget all about the relaxation issue, because the evidence is very clear there. I mean, I've seen all this evidence, as masses of it. It doesn't help at all, or not much, and only under some circumstances. What's more relevant to what we're talking about here is, do you think as a scientist that meditating anything like this higher consciousness mystical thing you were talking about, do you think that having first-person experience of that would help you as a scientist?
Well, almost certainly. I mean, just as first-person experience in psychophysics. I mean, this is the problem with the old school of psychophysics. You know, they're saying you shouldn't rely on first-person psychophysics. They just keep pressing buttons. In other words, study perception of red or blue or stereo, but not because it's interesting, because you experience stereo or red or blue, but treat it like a pigeon. Treat the person like a pigeon. You know, which is just rubbish.
Yeah.
And that dominated the field for 25, 30 years. And there's few people like Richard and Bella who came along and said that's not true. And I think that's going to be equally true of mental states. I mean, so I think that first person experience is definitely, I can't say for sure, because maybe it's all mumbo jumbo, but I think even, and that, and phenomena like hypnosis. But I think, you know, that you need to do, the trouble is this parallel world phenomenon, parallel universe. The people in that field don't want to be studied. They say, oh, we know it's true. The people who are scientists say, well, it's all phenomenology, it's vague, stay away from it. And what you need is people who are willing, and you've done that to some extent, people who are willing to develop links between these two domains of inquiry so that Eastern mysticism becomes legitimate or not legitimate. You know, you can find out.
That was Dr. Susan Blackmore speaking with V.S. Ramachandran. You can find out more about Susan at susanblackmore.co.uk. And for more interviews like this and the very best news and analysis of the worlds of science and technology, make sure you listen to our Science Weekly podcast. Head to guardian.co.uk/science for more.
Guardian Unlimited.